Well, good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to this week's episode of It's Easy Sun. And as fate would have it, I have with me today a very special friend, a friend and a colleague. I call her family. She has known her now with my wife, and my children have known her for a number of years as we are members of the Park Church. And I am more than excited because she's a scholar, an educator, someone who is an author, a speaker, motivator. We could go on and on and on. That will come out in our course of our conversation today. But ladies and gentlemen, I welcome to the podcast this week, Dr. Ella Bell, my good friend, and I would say my family member from Charlotte.
Dr. Bell, how are you? So proud of you. So excited about all that you are doing. The book. I remember when we talked about the book.
Yes, ma'am.
I remember you said to me, you sent me a little text, you know, I need to talk to you. I want to write a book. How do I do this? that was a pretty long time ago. And then all the CFO positions in higher education at some of the best universities, including Morehouse. I mean, I'm just looking in wonder at watching you fly and go. And it's just wonderful. And it's a great blessing. The kids are all grown up. I'm feeling old, girl. I'm feeling old.
I feel old myself to see grad school and all the things that they're doing. We're just tremendously blessed, and for that we give God the praise and the glory. Today, this episode is going to be fun because we're going to learn about you, your history, your early years, and your stellar career that you have, and you continue to inspire people. So like all my guests before me, it's an open-ended conversation. I'll just ask you a couple of questions that are open-ended, and based upon your responses, derivative questions will come up, and I will ask questions. And before you know it, an hour, has rolled along, and you'll be like, wow, how did it end so quickly? So that's what we'll do today. So let's just get started. Who is Ella Bell? Where is she from? Family? What grounds her? Her roots?
My roots, my homeland happens to be the Bronx, New York, New York City. I'm a New Yorker. I still identify with being a Bronx girl, a homie. We started out in the South Bronx, my mother, my father, and I. I'm also adopted. So they got me when I was about 6 weeks old, and we lived in the South Bronx, and we moved probably when I was 12 to the east side of the Bronx, which was more integrated. In the South Bronx, I went to a primarily inner city school where, you know, we played house until fourth grade. I kid you not. You know, you go into class and the day the teacher would divide you up, who was going to the block corner, the doll corner, the painting corner. There was not a lot of academic rigor at all. And we could only go to school part time because the school was so crowded. So my mother and several other parents, mothers, got together and got the Board of Education to actually bus us over to the west side of the Bronx. That was primarily white, Jewish, with empty classrooms. So I was one of the first groups in New York to be bused due to integration and overcrowding and all that other kind of good stuff that was keeping inner city kids back. So it's been an interesting journey being a New Yorker and understanding the racial rubric, urban style, New York style. And I always tell people, you know, the South was rough, but don't think that the North was, you know, free from any type of discrimination and anything else, particularly in my age group. And I'm 71. I'm up there a little bit, and can look back and see what our parents had to do so that we could get a quality education. We were probably the first cohort group to really enter college in great numbers.
Wow.
I was part of that cohort group, you know, that the doors opened and we were able to get through, but not without consequence. Not without consequence.
So South Bronx, New York, in that time, I'll be the first to tell you, I didn't know that much about New York's history till I lived in upstate New York and learned about the state.
Yep.
And then realized this north and south divide was interesting. But while you're growing up in the inner city and your family, mom, dad, adopted parents, what was your home like in terms of seeing what you're seeing out in school? But was there a balance between school life, home life, and was it integrated in some ways?
You know, people talk about this now and we're always like, oh, I can't believe you said that. There was something positive about being all together before integration started. You had doctors living in your neighborhood. You had the dentists living in your neighborhood. You had your stores. They weren't owned by Blacks necessarily. We had a butcher store that was to die for that was owned by Italians. I mean, just to die for. My favorite thing as a little girl was going with my mother to the butcher shop. Food has always been my thing, okay? My mother didn't work. A lot of the parents of my classmates did work. We were pretty blessed. My father worked in Midtown Manhattan, right across the street from a little store named Bloomingdale's. He worked on 59th Street. At a place called Lloyd's Distributors. And Lloyd's Distributors was a little antique store, French antique store, owned by the Zestmans, a Jewish family, that got passed down from generations. And if you've ever walked in Midtown Manhattan, you still see stores like this, or furniture stores where chairs are hanging from the ceiling, chandeliers, I mean, all reproductive work. You could go into Lloyd's and find any Hollywood actress, Broadway actor, corporate, whatever, because they got furniture from there. We had beautiful furniture in our home. We had gorgeous furniture in our home. My father managed the place. While we lived in the Bronx, I had a lot of early exposure to Midtown Manhattan. You know, our store, it was Bloomingdale's. You know, my father had a Black credit card in Bloomingdale's. Don't ask me how a man with an eighth grade education had a Black card in Bloomingdale's, but he did.
He did.
So, you know, the illusion that everybody from the inner city in New York, particularly the Bronx, didn't have any wherewithal. We had wherewithal. I was very, very lucky, very, very blessed. My parents weren't educated, but they had an awareness. My mother was very active in politics. Once we moved to the east side of the Bronx, my parents entertained Governor Rockefeller for lunch.
Wow.
It was part of the co-op where we lived was highly integrated. And it was underwritten by the Ford Foundation and HUD and to help working class folks have a middle income lifestyle, if you will.
Yeah.
And Rockefeller was getting good credit for that. And he wanted to come see. So my mother was the one that hosted, you know, the lunch for Rockefeller. And, you know, it was on the television and yada, 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 yada.
Wow.
So while I grew up, started off in the inner city, I probably had an atypical inner city upbringing. School was not. school was the one place where, you know, you knew that something was really off. I hated school when I was growing up.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
I would have never thought that.
And I was a chronic underachiever. Chronic underachiever. Had a terrible foundation. I remember when we got bussed fourth grade. Fifth grade, I started in this new school on the west side. I think it was PS 86. Oh, I hated going. There was one other black girl in my class, and I still remember Doreen Kyle. She actually lived in that neighborhood. The kids in that class I was placed in, they were reading Shakespeare. I kid you not. In the school that I had come from, we were reading C, Dick, and Jane Run.
Wow.
Here comes Spot.
Wow. Wow.
So you get bussed in and, you know, they're reading Shakespeare and I'm literally pointing with my finger. And one of the things that they did, I don't think it was intentional, but the racial ignorance was amazing. My mother was always at school, always for something. We couldn't go to the assemblies. And when I was a kid, that was a big deal. You got dressed up in your little midi outfit, you know, looking all cute. Get to school, assembly day, you're online to go into and see the puppet show or hear the policeman or whatever. And you got pulled out. All the kids that were busted got pulled out. You over here. And they were nasty about it, you know, and all the white kids could look at you and see. And then we got hushed into a room with a woman named, teacher named Mrs. Hoffman. I still remember her name, okay? She had a ruler. And she used to love my knuckles with her ruler. Because I was pointing, you know, and she was like, bam! You know, no, you can't point. No, stop it. I learned how to read. I went from like a 2.0 reading level in fifth grade to a seventh grade reading level. The thing that I never got though was remedial math. So till this day, I cannot count. Don't let the PhD fool you. I can't do multiplication. I can't do long division. Fractions and percentages tear me up, okay? Tear me up. Yeah. Because I never got, my foundation was really, my educational foundation was horrible. Wow. And I wasn't the only one. My parents, you know, they had the wherewithal to get tutors. That helped a little bit. I think I actually have a learning disability around numbers and putting numbers together and being able to picture. Nobody really showed me alternative ways of learning. That wasn't the end thing in those days. You either memorized or you were dead. And I wasn't memorizing that. So it was hard. It was not a fun experience for me, per se.
I'm stunned to hear this because you are a highly acclaimed academician. So that's very interesting. So
places where I'm not supposed to be.
I want to see how this so through grade school, you're bussed in high school. What was high school like on your way? And then from high school, what was next?
Okay, so I'm gonna be brutally honest with you because that's who I am.
Yep.
Junior high school, I'm in a new school, we've moved, and I'm doing fine on reading, but the math is killing me. So I cheated seventh and eighth grade with Lynn Wooten. She sat right next to me. Lynn Frazier, that was her name.
Yeah.
And she knew I couldn't do the math, so she would always show me. But came time for the standardized test, I couldn't do that. So on the standardized test, I came in like zero.
Wow.
So we get to, it's time to go to high school now. And I'm put in remedial math for the first time. And everybody else is taking algebra and I'm taking remedial math. 10th grade, I finally get to algebra while everybody's taking geometry. And New York is notorious, New York State, for something called the Regents. Mm. And you can pass a course, you can get straight A's all term. But if you fail the Regents, you fail the course.
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So I was barely passing algebra, like 65. But on the Regents, I flunked the Regents 3 times in algebra.
Wow.
The third time, I said, that's it. Okay, so I went to the guidance counselor and I said to her, now mind you, I was passing biology Regents, history Regents, other science Regents, English Regents. You know, I was fine as long as I didn't have to calculate. And I told the guidance counselor that she needed to take me out of the academic, because in New York, in those days, they tracked you. You had you didn't have, what do they call the schools now? Magnet. We didn't have magnet schools, right? So they tracked you. And academic, which meant you were going to college. Commercial, secretary, or distributive education, which basically meant, you know, you weren't going to be trained too much to do anything, in my humblest opinion, as an educator. I told the guidance counselor, make me commercial. Take me out of academic, I'll be a secretary. And I really wanted to do acting. I had done off-Broadway. I had done acting throughout junior high school. And I was in the Helen Hayes, what was it? Theater for non-professional children. I used to go downtown from the Bronx on the train every Saturday morning. So I really had gotten the acting bug in me, and commercial was fine with me because I was going to go to be an actress, so I thought. When I came home after transferring, my parents really didn't say anything. I think my mother was concerned. Hmm. He had a sixth grade education. My dad had an eighth grade education. And his idea of a successful daughter was that that I would be able to take care of myself. You know, and his idea for that is, well, you can work at Bell Telephone Company. That'll be fine. You know, you could be a dental hygienist. I mean, they thought trade. They did not think, you know, academics. And if you're not good in academics, well, but here's the flip side of that. My biological father was third generation physician.
Oh, wow.
My biological mother, all of my grandparents, all of my biological grandparents had master's degrees from New York schools, even though they lived in the South. The DNA, my father graduated from high school at 13. He finished Howard at 16. I mean, Shaw at 16, went to Shaw. He finished Shaw at 16. Wow. Then they made him wait to get into Howard's medical school.
Wow.
So, you know, my adoptive parents were looking at me going, well, what is wrong here? there was a big disconnect. And I remember I got placed because I'm now secretarial trained. I can't do stenography. They don't even teach stenography anymore. I could not do stenography. I couldn't remember. I wanted to try to draw the little signals, so squiggles. So yeah. I got in trouble on that. And I remember I was sitting in the college office because it was my job to do the filing in the college office. That was my little internship. And the man who ran the college office was Mr. Allweis. And Mr. Allweis came into his office, and I'm sitting in the office at 8:30 in the morning crying like a baby because I'm filing all of my friends' duplicate college applications. All of my friends are still academic. Everybody's going to college. Historical context, Lyndon B. Johnson is president. He doesn't want to be perceived as a racist. So all of a sudden, everybody is scrambling to get, you know, working class kids in college, black kids in college, the few brown kids in college. I mean, that was the pull then. And I'm just boo-hooing. And he was like, "What? Why are you crying?" And I was like, "Everybody's going to college but me. I'm going to work for Bell's Telephone Company." Poor man. He pulled my record. And he said to me, he said, "I couldn't understand why you were commercial." And when he pulled my record to see how I was in anything non-quantitative, so he called my parents in and he said, and this is my beginning of my senior year. He said, we've got to flip the script on this one. Your daughter is college material.
Wow.
I think my mother brought it into it. My father was like, "Well, what does this mean?" What it meant was that I had to go and take algebra again with the same teacher that flunked me 3 times. Who announced to the 9th grade class, "Well, this is what happens when you don't pass the algebra regents and you want to go to college." But he did pass me.
Yeah.
He did pass me, but I wanted to kill him. And then I had to make up other courses as well. So the senior year when everybody was, you know, I only have 2 classes. I was at school from 8 o'clock in the morning to 4 o'clock in the afternoon. It was
but
hard.
But you got it done.
Yeah, it was, you know, I was determined. I lost face, I think, at times, you know. It was embarrassing when I think about it. It was painful. But I did it.
Yeah.
And I got into a little college called Mills College of Education. It was in New York. I felt that if I could become a teacher, I would be okay. And I could still study acting. And in the summer, you know, I was going to the acting academy. I did not care. And I loved kids. So that made sense to me. And once I got into college, which is a very small girls' school, kept me out of trouble every kind of way. Kept me out of trouble. But the long story short, it was in the village. So it was really cool. There were times it was a school for little rich white girls. There were 4 of us and 4 black girls in beginning in my class. Most of the girls came from very wealthy backgrounds. But that experience literally changed my life.
Wow.
I student taught on the Navajo Indian Reservation. I student taught in Great Britain. I took out a loan so that I could go to Great Britain. The loan didn't come in time, and my history teacher, who was the chaperone and led that particular trip, lent me the money until my student loan came in. I graduated president of the student council. I was president of the freshman class. It was like somebody just kind of hit me over the head, and I realized that, you know, I wasn't stupid, I wasn't inferior, I could do, and if people got out of my way, I could succeed. And that was a powerful lesson for me.
Well, as an educator, an accomplished educator today, and I'm listening to your story, which is fascinating, by the way. When you look at our young people, regardless of background or race or creed or whatever labels we use today, the tenacity that you had in that senior year alone, is that something you wished more young people would realize from an earlier age, especially in the economy that we're in that is so digital, quantitative, technology-based? Do you think your lived experience is like a testimony to what they should be striving for?
You know, I'm of this thought that anybody, if you work hard, you can do it. And there's more than one way to skin a cat. What my life journey has taught me is that if you're meant to do something, you will do it. If you work and if you're determined. I remember when I came out of college, everybody thought I would go teach at some little private school in Manhattan. I went back to the school that, you know, I was reading Dick and Jane. Wow. You know, if I had looked hard enough, I would have found the textbook that I had been given as a kid, you know. And I remember that my second year was 123, CES 123. And I remember 1 year I had six kids to get 100 on the reading test.
Wow.
And they came in, this counselor, and took the students out to get them retested because they thought I gave them the answers.
Oh my goodness.
And they retested, and when you know that all those kids got 100 again, and I'm on Facebook with many of those kids now. I share that in the belief that if you believe, and I, you know, I would just level with them, you know, people think you're stupid. So when you're acting out, you're just living into what they expect. Why don't you show them something different?
Wow, yeah.
You know, you get a sub, if I'm sick and I'm not here and you get a sub and she's got you playing, you know, puzzles all day, you all need to go to the vice principal and say, you know, hey, we're not learning. And did you know they did not do that? they had a substitute come in. I was really sick, so I was out of school for a little while. And this woman kept giving them, you know, like, you know, Mickey Mouse stuff to do. So at lunchtime, they went to the assistant principal and said, you know, Mrs. Holly said, I was Mrs. Holly then. Mrs. Holly said that if we got somebody teaching us Mickey Mouse stuff, we should report it. So the vice principal wound up taking over the class. Wow. And that sub went bye-bye. I think you've got to tell students, you've got to tell children what people expect and what the realities are. You've got to tell them, you know, when somebody is bamboozling you, you've got to let them know, no, you're not going to bamboozle me, even when you're in second and third grade. Mm. You've got to teach children not to talk back, but to be able to understand early on how to use their voice. And I was very clear, I want you to always be respectful. There's no substitute for respect. You know, I will knock you upside your head if you're not being respectful. But you need to be able to be an advocate for yourself, because basically you're in the South Bronx. People don't think you're going to be able to achieve anything.
Wow.
They don't think you're worthy. Okay. Wow. So you can buy into that by acting it out, or you can show them exactly how worthy you are. And I think that's a message that we've got to give our children more than ever today, because the messaging is just so destructive. It's so narrow. It's so negative. They need to know, don't drink the Kool-Aid. That's not who you are. Mm. Let me explain to you who you are.
Wow.
Let me be real clear with you who you are. They need to understand that, even if they come from really dire circumstances, because dire circumstances teaches you to persevere. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got to reframe the pain that a lot of these kids, because, you know, when you teach, particularly in the elementary school or any public setting, quite honestly, the stories that you hear from the students, the children, are just devastating. I mean, how are you able to get up out of bed, you know, given the fact that you've seen your father beat your mother, or, you know, there was a fire in your building, your apartment got covered with smoke, but it's still intact, and your grandmother can't move. So you're living in this smoke-infested apartment building where the stairs is literally hanging on by ropes. And basically, you shouldn't be in there because it's not healthy any which way. It's not right. Safe any which way.
Right.
You know, so, you know, you're dealing with kids. It's almost like being in a war zone. because of what you're seeing and what these kids are going through. So, you know, we used to do different things. I think it's part of the reason why my first marriage didn't last. Because one week, you know, I brought home all the girls. We had a, everybody got sleeping bags. So, you know, I got everybody, parents, bring them over, the girls. So we had girl weekend. You know, my husband looked at me as if I was crazy. He was an accountant in a top 8 accounting firm. So his idea of life was a lot different than what I was dealing with in the classroom. Then we had another time when we took the boys, which he did come, he enjoyed that. We took the boys to a basketball game, you know. How do you expose? The week before the reading test, we went to St. Patrick's Cathedral. Why? To light candles. We wanted to tell God, you know, we got to do well on this reading. You know, parents wouldn't come to school. I send you a telegram. You know, you get a telegram from, you know, Mrs. Holly, you know, your child is acting up. You better get in here. It was just, you know, it was just, I expect you. Oh, you can't pass the spelling test? At one point he had, can't remember his name, but he just had a heckified time passing spelling. I mean, he had a learning disability. I said, okay. I said, every word you get a quarter. Okay. Man, he racked up. He started getting money. He started passing the spelling test. Now, yeah. I would say that I'd probably go to jail today for my wonderful teaching techniques. but the reality of it was, by any means necessary, right, that you learn you're worthy, that you learn you're smart, that, you know, you learn that there's many ways to skin a cat, because as a Black child, as a Hispanic child, as a Puerto Rican child, you are going to have to learn that. That's the reality of our lives.
Yeah.
And the sooner you learn that, the better.
Yeah, absolutely. But going back to your story, and I could, now I'm seeing the passion of your education and your love for it. But you went on to Columbia. You are teaching. You went on and got your PhD. You're teaching at some of the most elite institutions, Ivy League, Dartmouth, MIT, Sloan. I'm like, so that's why I'm having a hard time processing what you shared earlier. And now the Ella Bell, the Dr. Bell we know now, and the lives that you touch and the people that you have educated up to the upper crust of higher education. How did you transition from that to where you are today and your degrees and your impact you've had on so many people at these elite institutions?
I'm thankful, number one. I realize who's put me there. And it's God. I'm real clear about when I got my PhD, I was getting my PhD to understand why particularly African-American women were not succeeding. And, you know, why we always hear, whoa, poor white women, but, you know, Black women are, you know, the dirt of the earth. Like, wait a minute, what's that all about? God put me there. I'm very clear about, you know, who put me where I've been. And I'm also real clear that I have gotten around possibly every rule you could think of. And I'm not talking about affirmative action. When I went to apply for my PhD, at the time I applied, I went to Case Western. They did not require the graduate record exam. Thank you, Jesus. Because they had no idea how ignorant I was on the quantitative side. It was just like, yay, thank you, Lord. I kid you not, I got a 310 on my SAT in math and a 320 in English. And when I tell people that, they're like, what? I don't take tests well. But I think, when I think about I couldn't open those doors by myself. Let me be real clear about that. God opened those doors for me. And I don't ever forget that, particularly in places like MIT. I mean, I was so intimidated to be at MIT, to be honest. I was intimidated when I went to Yale. I mean, I didn't talk for the longest time because I was just like, somebody's going to find out that I'm really an idiot and I don't belong here. Talk about imposter syndrome. Mm-hmm. But then I started finding out about my biological family. And I got from humble to arrogant real quick, real wow. quick. Because Yale was one of the family schools. I had three cousins who had gone to Yale. One in math, as a matter of fact. Alan went in math. I found out my father spoke five languages and, you know, was a major doctor. And David Dinkins was one of his buddies. You know, it was like, really?
Wow.
I found out about who I was. And as a scholar of leadership, I think it's real important, particularly for Black folks and for women, to understand what they're bringing to the table, even under adversary conditions. I think that's when we learn our most in terms of how to be leaders. That's how we develop what I call your leadership chops. Because every time you get hit, every time you're told you're inferior, every time you're told that you're not qualified, every time you're told that you're not worthy, you pick yourself back up. And every time you pick yourself back up, your leadership muscles, they strengthen, they get stronger, they develop. That's your leadership narrative.
Wow. So Columbia, Case Western, all of these upper crust institutions, I'm assuming that your time there, and you just mentioned the narrative that you saw or your PhD work around empowering African-American women.
Mm-hmm.
You wrote a book, a very acclaimed book.
Which is coming back out. We've got Harvard to reissue.
Okay, well, I want to talk to you a little bit about that because, you know, I'm a husband and I have a daughter.
Mm-hmm.
I can see things through a different lens in that regard. But as you are, or you were back then, getting ready to start this PhD program, and you said you noticed this, but that has become almost your life's work in my home.
Yes. Yep.
So what triggered it for you and what sustains you in advocating for women of color in the workplace or wherever situation they find themselves in? What was the trigger for you that sent you down this path?
Well, I think it was one of two things. The fact that I had experienced racism at the hands of white females. When I got bussed into that all white school, I remember I had a pair of shoes. Another little white girl had same shoes. Mine were a little dusty because I'm hard on shoes. But I remember trying to connect with her and I was like, oh, wow, we've got the same shoes. And she said, I don't have shoes like you. Now, we don't have the same shoes. I was like, okay. There was always that adversarial relationship with white girls that, you know, somehow you weren't pretty enough. I wasn't pretty enough. You know, I wasn't good on, and my clothes came from Bloomingdale. So who are you talking to? You know, I had a sense of arrogance even then as a child, which is not good, but I had it. So I think that's one thing. And I honestly believe the other thing for me, and it became clearer as we did the research, Stella Nkomo and I, for Our Separate Ways, the book you're referring to, and for my dissertation, was that I always knew I was, well, I found out I was adopted when I was probably about 4 years old. My parents had a child psychologist, and it wasn't not a here are your parents, but more of, you know, what's the bird that brings you, that delivers babies, you know, it was, yeah, it was that kind of story, you know, your parents found you probably in the bulrushes somewhere, you know, you got no information about your biological family at all. Mm-hmm. And I remember going through that experience and wondering all my childhood, you know, who could possibly be my parents? You know, where did I come from? And that always bothered me. That has always caused me anxiety, that separation. I've had anxiety, I think, since the day I was born. And I'm just now realizing how deep the anxiety goes. But I knew that my parents, my heritage was upper class Black. I didn't realize it was as integrated as it was. But I did know because, you know, my mother would tell me, well, you know, you come from a very good background. You come from a good background. Well, what's that mean? You know, I can't count, so it can't be that good, you know. you know, my mother would say, I don't understand why your hair is not, you know, straight. What's that got to be? You know, why should my hair be straight? You know, I don't understand this. For me, particularly researching professional Black women, I was trying to find and give voice to what my life might have been, what I had missed by being adopted, what I had missed by being adopted by working class, wonderful parents, but working class, not educated. When I was told I came from a highly educated, upper class background. So, you know, for me, that had to be the professional women. Well, there were a few professional women like that, but a lot of them were just like me. You know, the ones that were really successful, many of them came from very, very humble backgrounds, and just as complicated as my Black background. So for me, it was giving me some kind of re-storytelling so that I could think about my life differently. And once I made the discovery of who my biological family, you know, who they were, what was very interesting that a lot of the women we had interviewed, they actually knew members of my biological family. So I think I was the type of kid, and I'm still, and Clay used to say, I'm like a pit bull. I always want to put the pieces, and I'm going to rework those pieces over and over and over again until it makes sense to me. My process is external. Most people process internally. I know myself well enough to know my process is external. So I'm going to talk it through 1,000 times. I'm going to, you know, beat it to death until I even figure out what it means to me and who I am. What it means in terms of what are my next steps, what it means in terms of why I am here and what's my mission, so to speak. And I've been like that. I've been like that a pretty long time.
Yeah.
So yeah.
You said something interesting. You process things externally. Now, you're an organizational behavior expert in a corporate setting or any setting. It seems to me as if you had these innate gifts on the inside all along that's well-suited for what you do now. Is that a fair statement?
That's a very fair statement.
Okay. So
a consultant is always marginal. You never see on my resume that I worked for this company or that company. I was a school teacher. But I've never worked for a, I can survive, I can thrive in a marginal position, which is what consultants do. We don't belong, we're there to facilitate a process. I can also thrive as a Black woman, as a, you don't have to accept me, you know, you don't want, I'm okay with that. You know, yeah. I don't mind being more, I don't need to be the queen of I don't need to be the prom queen. You know, I like being under the, I like to be incognito, underneath the radar, so that I can do what I want to do. I'm not looking for the glory and the, you know, you would have never known any about this, about me at church.
No.
No, my resume, my this, my that, you know, people know, they know I'm a professor. I think most folks know I'm a professor, but they don't have a clue.
Yeah. Well, I would say this to you. I've always walked from a distance because you don't get to be a professor at these institutions by just being a professor. I want to make sure that my audience understands you don't get to teach at these institutions by just being a professor. So I want to make sure that
folks at church don't know about the institutions. You don't see me talking about, well, I'm a professor at.
You don't need to do that.
I am comfortable being my upbringing, my sense of being marginal in my family that raised me. I was loved, but you know, if you're adopted, you always, at least I was, well, where do I really belong? My parents were the age of grandparents. And to be honest with you, my godfather was my maternal grandfather. And I didn't find that out until I was like 19, 20.
Wow.
His daughter was my mother, who I never ever saw.
Yeah.
They had a summer home in Belmar, New Jersey, that I went to go spend one summer at. And I looked so much like my mother, apparently, that after that one trip, I never got to go back. And they had a brownstone in Bed-Stuy. And I never went to see them in Brooklyn. You know, they always came to the Bronx where we lived. I never went to their home in Brooklyn.
Wow. Wow. I have a question to ask you.
What?
If you're following the news, you will see what Goldman Sachs did last week.
Yep.
$10 billion over 10 years. So when you hear those types of initiatives for women of color, you see a Melody Hobson, you see the new Starbucks CEO, you see all these Walgreens CEO, you see all these women of color rising. We now have Vice President Harris. What does that do to your heart in terms of the work that you have been engaged in? Is it something that warms your heart, or you're saying we still need to do more?
We still need to do more. I mean, I'm one does not make a difference. When you say Melody Hobson, when you say Vice VP Harris, I am very proud of their accomplishments. Don't get me wrong. Mm-hmm. But the thing that we need to do, it's not the one or two. I'm the Ella Bell is an exception to the rule. Okay. We take the exceptions to the rule and we act like we're doing a whole lot. Mm-hmm. We're not. Goldman Sachs is good in terms of where they, and I trust Erica. Erica is amazing. She's at Goldman. Kudos, because she's just astounding. But the reality of it is where those monies go and how we monitor those monies, and what kinds of programs get developed and what kinds of skills the women are getting is going to be even more important, and monitoring what they do with that and what kind of support. We really are good sometimes at, not all the time, at throwing money, but it takes more to have success than having money thrown at a group. Right. You've got to have development. You've got to, and I don't call it training. You train dogs. You train animals.
Right, right.
Okay. So there's got to be programs around development. There's got to be programs around financial training. That I would call training. There's got to be programs around self-worth and self-esteem. because we're hard on ourselves. We're rough on ourselves. We sacrifice. Black women are very, very good at not taking care of themselves. Mm. We get into superwoman syndrome and we just, you know, take it to the next, to take it to Pluto. You can't mm-hmm. be successful when you do that. You just yeah. can't. We take care of everybody. When you start looking at our networks, when you start looking about our family relations and the decades and decades of DNA pathology, old habits of survival for Black women. Hopefully these funds will provide resources so that we can help women break those habits of survival that are not needed, won't be needed as they climb up the mobility ladder. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. And I'll tell you one, you know, Gerald, whenever I research, and I knew exactly how you probably would have answered that question. So I asked that question a specific way to say if we need to do more, or my derivative question from that, obviously we need to do more. But in the work that you're doing and what you see happening in our nation today, we definitely need to do more. But how do you see it in terms of the empowerment piece that your answer was alluding to? How do you see that?
Let me backtrack too. You can have a Black woman CEO, but if there's no pipeline behind her, it doesn't really mean very much. Hmm. You know, we've had a constellation, a small constellation of Black male CEOs. And if you think about it now, those companies are headed by, you know, white men, maybe one white woman. But the reality of it is that if there's no pipeline behind you, you're just doing a solo act. Okay. Mm. So don't mistake what might be solo acts. Don't mistake and throwing money at one group when we have systemic issues. How do those funds address systemic issues that Black women are caught in? Like housing, like net worth, like health. Okay, you can throw money at a group, yeah, but it's the systemic issues. Will that necessarily change the systemic issues that plague the everyday realities of not just Black women, but Black men, Black children, Black families, the Black community?
Mm-hmm. Oh my goodness. So you are gonna go back out on the road with your book when it's relaunched, correct?
Yeah, I think so.
I hope so. Well, you know, like I do with all the guests that are on the show, and I knew this was going to be a very good conversation because my wife and I have this conversation a lot, especially about our daughter. Mm-hmm. And when she got accepted to the school she got accepted to, she didn't want us to tell anybody.
Yeah. Yeah.
She did not want us to tell a soul that she had gotten into MIT. Yep. And I never understood why until later she broke it down for us because she is caught between going to this school, and I'm a Howard grad, so, you know, I was pushing, but that was her dream school. And as a parent, you want to support your child.
Right.
When she explained to us the tension between the two, it speaks to exactly what you're referring to. And that's why I talked to you about the empowerment aspects of it. But for young girls, young professional women, or just people in general, young people in general, because that's what this podcast is about, is to try to inspire, bring hope. In the midst of what you're seeing now, what would be some words of wisdom, hope, and inspiration you could share to say to them, look, we're in a moment or a dispensation in time, but if you do A, B, C, I don't know, any words of inspiration along those lines would be great just to hear from you.
I think it's important to realize that there's many a way and I always come back to it, to skin a cat. Faith is really important. You got to believe in something. You know, you can't go out here thinking that it's all you. I'm standing on shoulders, my mother's shoulders, my father's shoulders. I'm standing, and both biological and adopted. I'm standing on teachers' shoulders. So, you know what I mean?
Yes.
You know the word I'm trying to say.
Shoulder.
Yes, thank you. And, you know, some of those folks are white. Many of those folks are white. You've got to make sure that you are building relationship. Relationship is critical. Why is that? You can work your tail off. We know that women and people of color go in the workplace and work hard, and they don't see the fruit of their labor. If you don't build relationship, and unfortunately in this day and age, that's still on you. People are more aware, but you do have to figure out, okay, who's at least saying good morning to me? Because I can start there. Where's the easiest one person you can find to start with? That is critically important. You've got to believe in yourself and get out of your way. You know the old saying, be careful what you ask for.
Yes.
So often we think we want something, and we do want it, but when it comes, it's like, oh my God. By the time I talk myself down out of the tree, the opportunity might be gone.
Yes.
So, you've got to realize that if you ask for it, you probably can do it, you know, and get out of your way. I think one of the things that disempowers, particularly Black women, is that we get in our own way. We stop believing. We drink the Kool-Aid. You know, we are hard on ourselves. We're very hard on us. We're hard on others. You know, we're known for being direct and, you know, telling it like it is. And, well, you know, we do that to ourselves as well. It's just that when we do it to other people, we are doing it to ourselves. Mm-hmm. And, you know, grace is important. I always tell women who are successful, what I've observed is that they have gig. G-I-G.
Oh, what's that?
They've got grit. You know, the bounceability, grit, not aggressiveness. You got to reframe the negativity. I'm not aggressive. I've got grit. I've got determination. I'm feisty. I stand up. No, you will not out-talk me. My boundaries are clear. I know who I am. Okay, and I know what I'm bringing to the table. I need to let you know that every now and then. Okay, so you got to have grit. And when you close the door, I got to find a way to get around, get in that door anyway. You know, you don't stop me. I've got grit. Mm. I've got courage. I've got perseverance. I've got determination, grit. You got to be able to influence. Influence is another word for power. You know, in this country, we don't like to talk about women in power, no matter what color they are. So when you start talking about, well, I'm a powerful woman, I got influence. I have networks. I know who my stakeholders are. I know how to analyze my data because I know how to influence people in numerous ways, not just by talking, but my analysis is tight. You know, my skill set is tight. So when I'm trying to persuade you, I know how to build my argument, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
I know how to build bridges in this day and age. Gotta know how to build bridges in this day and age. My God, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's not all about me. People who influence realize that, you know, they're not the only, you know, cheese in town. Okay. There are multiple folks that sometimes got bigger and better cheese than what I got, you know?
Right.
Influence is important. And then last but not least is grace. You know, you can't be so big and bad that you don't understand humility, that you don't give hope. that you can't care, have compassion. In this day and age, not to have compassion. Just look at the difference with the Biden administration, Biden-Harris administration. Mm-hmm. I mean, I cried during inaugural week when they stood at the reflection pond and had silence for all the people that we've lost, including my godmother during the COVID, that the other man didn't seem to understand, him and his little boys and girls, didn't seem to get compassion. What's that? We need to be able to give compassion, hope, a lifeline, if you will. Give people a chance, if you will. Allow people to grow, forgive. That's all part of grace. Gotta have all three if you're gonna succeed out here, particularly if you're a woman of color.
Wow, Dr. Bell, that was, wow. Ooh, that was heavy. I'm gonna make sure that my daughter listens to this. She listens to some, but not all. But I will tell you that, I had Dr. Otis Moss on about 3 weeks ago. And similar to what you said, you gotta get that purpose, the commitment, and then you gotta turn that into, you get to your purpose, mission, commitment, purpose, and service. Yeah. And all of that is wrapped around in grace. And wow, what a way for us to come. See, we're at an hour and we could go on for much longer.
You didn't know what you were getting into.
I didn't have a clue. Yeah, I knew what I was getting into. And that's why I wanted to have you on the show, because what you just shared is exactly what I hear from parents, grandparents, mothers of daughters, even before, the show is entitled It's Easy Son, but we had Sonia Nichols on and she reminded me, easy son and daughter. But at the end of the day, what we're about is trying to empower young people and get people to see those that have gone before them. And they're not movie stars. They're not all these things you see on TV, but they do have impact. And you, Dr. Bell, Ella, so you don't beat me up the next time you see me, you are one of those people, and I'm just so thankful and gracious that you took some time to spend with me this weekend. Anything that you'd like to share as we close out? Any words? You shared a lot of wisdom and nuggets, but anything on your heart you want to share?
Just don't drink the Kool-Aid. It's amazing. If you just trust, it will all happen. And I've learned that. It's taken me 71 years to learn that. If you just trust and keep your heart open, it will all happen. The work, the career, the love. I think about Clay coming back into my life, because we met when we were 5 years old in a sandbox. It will all come if you just be patient. And if you do stay in your lane and do what you know your mission is to be, it'll all come.
Amen.
And that's the thing. When I look back, and I think when you get at this stage of my life, I look back and it's like, okay, what's the takeaway? And it's like, wow. I was worrying about would the husband show up, would that show up? The children didn't come, but I had some choice in that too. And I've got great God kids. I've got the best God kids in the whole universe. So, I have my students, there's many ways of having children in this world. And I truly, as an adopted kid, I truly, truly believe that. But if I were to look back at this stage of my life, the thing that becomes clear, all the things I had anxiety about, guess what? It happened. I could have maintained my cool and my calm and my serenity. It all comes. Trust the process. Take time to enjoy the journey.
Absolutely. Wow. Well, Ella, I want to make sure I say it right before we go. Thank you so much for joining us this week. This is going to be one of the fun episodes of this podcast series. Well, ladies and gentlemen, there you have it, my good friend, Dr. Ella Bell. She's shared quite a bit over this hour. And it's my hope and my prayer that something was shared, something was said, that gives you an opportunity to look at your station in life through a different lens. That's what we're about with this show and this podcast. And we hope that you continue to tune in. So until next week, this is It's Easy Sun. Your life's journey onto your purpose. So until next week, stay safe and be strong. God bless.